everybody. You are listening to Limited Playtime, the board game podcast where we bring you board game reviews in 30 minutes or less.
Or the next episode is free.
I am Kyle Bolin.
And I'm Jason Cavallari.
And we are back from JasonCon 2022, which is basically just Jason's house, and I'm there, and we play games.
Brian keeps saying it should be called KyleCon because we do it when you come here.
We should really just call it like LPTCon or something.
Oh yeah, there you go. Begin the branding.
That's the thing that actually makes sense, other than the fact that it is your house,
right?
But then it could also just be like, you know, BrianCon if we wanted to too. So
that's true.
LPTCon like serves all masters, so that would work the best. Anyway, so the very first game that we played at JasonCon, or LPTCon, or whatever you want to call it, in Boston, was a little game called War of the Ring, Second Edition, colon is silent. So this is a little game based on a movie called The Lord of the Rings. You may not know, Jason, but the movies were actually based on a book series that YA author named J.R.R. Tolkien wrote in like the 50s or something.
I'm aware, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Sure. Truly.
I believe it or not, I do know that.
Okay, so let's jump into this, and we'll try to avoid too many spoilers or, you know, going deep into the Silmarillion or anything like that.
Yes, let the song of what the hell is the thing called?
I don't know. You're trying to come up with like the song
Iluvatar.
Of like,
yes, the song of Iluvatar.
Right, yeah, the thing that Aragorn and what's her name are based on or whatever.
Sure.
They're like the reincarnation of or something like that. Yeah, all that nonsense. Anyway, so War of the Ring is published by Ares Games. It is designed by Roberto D'Amelio, Marco Maggi, Francesco Nepitello, and art is by John Howe.
One of these is not like the other.
Yes. It is. It says it's for 2 to 4 players. Never would have guessed that. And it says 150 to 180 minutes, which is probably a lie. Ages 13 plus. Weight of 4.18 out of 5. And that is War of the Ring. A game that I would say is not really 2 to 4 players, but very much a 2-player game.
I mean, I'm fairly certain it was designed as a 2-player game.
I'm fairly certain of that as well.
Yeah.
Because in this game, much like Rebellion, the Star Wars game that we have reviewed in the past, one person is playing one side of this conflict, meaning the free people. So like the people from the movies or the books that are allied with the hobbits and Gandalf the Wizard and Aragorn the Ranger. And of course, Boromir, everyone's favorite.
Right.
Or on the other side, Sauron, you know, the Eye. In the tower.
Mm-hmm. And the game is called the Shadow.
What control? Oh, yeah, like the Shadow people? The Shadow?
Yeah. I mean, the Shadow encompasses, like, Sauron and the Southerns and the Orthanc and, you know, all those people.
Yeah. So, like, Saruman, the other wizard, what controls the nasty orcs?
Yeah. As opposed to the not nasty orcs.
Well, they were a little nastier in the movie.
For sure.
Bigger and stronger and a little bit grosser.
Yeah, they were kind of slimy for some reason.
They got hatched out of that weird, like, butthole in the earth.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, they were made from, like, dirt and fire, but yet they were slimy.
It was wrong.
Yeah, it was just wrong.
Okay, so War of the Ring is a long game. I don't remember how long we were playing it, but I kind of rushed the end because I was like, we need to do other things today. I think we played for at least 3 hours, and that was with me rushing through to make sure that we had time to make a movie, get dinner, and maybe play another short game between all of that. So,
So
this is a game that I feel like you could look forward to playing like all day long if you really wanted to. Like if you really want to like agonize over every little decision that you make with your army and try to min-max all of your chances to succeed, I could see this going 5 or 6 hours.
I mean, I suppose. I mean, I've never played a game that long.
Probably average 4, right?
3-4. Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably accurate. So, you know, I guess the playing time here is, like, you know, largely accurate, but it did feel like a game that, you know, it's not, you're never going to have that familiarity with it where all of a sudden you're playing it in 2.5 hours or anything like that. It seems like a game that is designed to take its time with you.
Yeah, it also depends on like how much thought you wanted to put into your moves.
Yeah,
you know, it's. I mean, I suppose that's true of any game, really. It's like you could just sort of get the basic rules and say, okay, I'm just going to do this and see what happens. So,
sure.
You know.
But in this game, we'll talk about how you play it a little bit here, because I feel like it kind of like plays into what I'm saying here, is that there's basically like two different win goals, right? Like the Free Peoples have two win goals, which is to get the ring to Mordor and throw it in the volcano or whatever.
Yep.
Or to sack two of the shadow faction's cities that are worth four points. We were just looking at the board and I'm like, well, those two would work because they're worth two each.
Yeah.
And then for the shadow people, it's to basically like destroy the ring bears, which is represented by a track that you advance, or by sacking like 10 points of cities on the board of the Free Peoples. So those are all the different win conditions, and you're trying to do those two things. And I found that when trying to move the ring bearers to Mordor, that was an incredibly glacial process. You move them like at best like one space on the board per action, and there are probably like a couple dozen steps that they need to make in order to actually get to the end of that track. And that doesn't include any sort of like diversionary moves you need to make in order to try to avoid detection, to, you know, like reduce the progress that the evil player has made on the ring track that gets them closer to winning the game. So if I had really wanted to win the game with that particular tact, I would have needed to like hide my ring bearers in a well-protected and good aligned city, Free People's aligned city, and just let them sit for a little while. And when I realized that towards the end of the game, I was like, no, I don't have time for that. And so we just kind of like, I was just like, I'm just going to go for it. And I went for it. And of course that wasn't the wise decision at all. I knew I was going to lose doing that, but I just, you know, it was whatever. It's a, you know, throw the dice at the very end of the game.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, on the other side of the board, you were basically trying to go for the military victory, where you then, you know, you're playing dudes on a map where you are, like, summoning armies and then moving those armies across the map and then attacking my strongholds with them, which was an interesting thing because this game actually has, like, siege mechanics and stuff like that, or, you know, mechanics that represent siege warfare, you know, holding up as a defensive maneuver in a siege situation and all that. But that also kind of slowed the game down. There's a lot of things within this game that put the brakes on the pacing of the game, unlike a lot of other games where you could say, oh, well, you might like really agonize over min-maxing all of your choices, but a lot of those other games don't have brakes built into the system like this game does.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of those brakes are meant to sort of balance out the game, so like, and also to be you know, thematically coherent with the source material. So like, yeah, moving the ring bearers is the thing you have to do to get them to Mordor, but it's also incredibly risky.
Right.
Because every time you do it, it increases the probability that the shadow will locate where they are and corrupt the ring bearers, etc. So, you know, so it's one of those things where, like, yeah, you can move them to Mordor, but you don't, the game as a game, you don't want it to be like a straight shot that's really fast, because that, you know, that would be too easy. And so,
definitely,
and certainly not true to the source material either.
Yeah. Thematically it works. I wasn't saying that it is necessarily a bad thing that it has these breaks, these, like, you know, slow down mechanics, which are balancing mechanics, like you said, built into the system. I'm just saying they are there and they will create a long game for you. So if that's, that's like a caveat for this game, is that if you're not the kind of person that wants to sit down and play 4 hours of a game with another person on a Friday or a Saturday or Sunday, then you may not enjoy this game. If you're the kind of person that loves the idea of having a nice little, like, you know, cozy one-on-one competitive game that feels very epic and, you know, very thematic, then this might be your favorite game of all time.
Yeah, I think it can be a little disconcerting, I think, because, you know, when you see it, there's like all these little figures on the board, and you know, it's a massive player board, and you know, and you talk about having warfare and siege battles, and
there's a lot of
people on Nazgul and all this other kind of stuff. But I think at heart, it's less one of those dudes on a map game and more kind of like a strategy game, really.
Well, dudes on a map games are a type of strategy game.
True, yeah, but I think the sort of aesthetics of the game and the theme of the game make it seem like it's a little bit less on the strategy and more on the theme, except I think there is actually a lot more strategy involved than you would assume.
Yeah, yeah. I think that mechanically it's very sound. I think that when I said it's very theme heavy, I think what I mean is it's theme rich. Like the thematics are very, I mean, they're very present, and they're, you know, unlike some other games we've talked about lately, the mechanics help bring the theme to life.
Yeah, for sure.
Like we were talking about, what was the Euro we were just talking about last time we did an episode? Oh, it was Lost Ruins of Arnak, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we were talking about how the mechanics of that game don't really make the theme come to life at all. And that's true for lots of games, you know, Euros mm-hmm. and non-Euros. And with this game, it definitely felt like most of the time, especially most of the core mechanics, that the mechanics helped bring that theme to life in a way that a lot of games don't.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. The other side of that is that it's, you know, yes, on one hand, it's incredibly thematic, but on the other side, it sort of makes for a really, I don't want to say fiddly game, but it's kind of fiddly.
I don't know, a little fiddly. I would say heavy. You know, I think that heavy is probably the fairest way to say that.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, situational rules.
There are. There's a lot of rules. Just,
for sure.
You know, like, there's just a lot to learn. And as somebody that played it for the very first time for real, because we also sat down and tried this one night on Tabletop Simulator, and after banging our heads against it for about 45 minutes, I was just like, no, Jason, we're going to do this in person. This is not going to work. And then even in person, it was a pretty heavy lift for the first time. Not necessarily with following the turn-to-turn rules, because mm-hmm. at its heart, it's sort of like a dice action game, right? Like, that's kind of the driving yeah, mechanic behind yeah. it, is that both sides have a set number of dice and the free peoples have fewer, at least initial, pretty much always. Yeah. And you roll those dice, and whatever symbols show up on those dice, that dictates which actions you can take that turn, such as, you know, drumming up more people for your armies, or, you know, moving some of the different factions within your side closer to being able to go to war with the other side, things like that. Because mm-hmm. you know, at the beginning of the game, there's certain sort of like political states, and, you know, there's, you know, states with who owns what on the board that's all set up. And, you know, the dice basically allow you to change that board state. They allow you to move your characters and your figures and your armies across the board, potentially, as well as do other things like, you know, summon or play cards, because there's several different types of cards in this game, too, that all become very important. They allow you to do all kinds of, you know, card-based mechanics. They also get used in combat. There's basically, like, two halves to each card. The top half just has some sort of game effect that you play, like, during your normal turn or whatever, and then, like, on the lower half, it has something that will be beneficial in certain combats, and sometimes those are very situational as well. Sometimes yeah. they have triggers that have to be met, or, you know, like, situations that have to be met in order, conditions, in order to actually be played. So sometimes you'll have a handful of stuff that looks really great if you're in that situation, but, you know, you don't always find yourself in that situation. So, you know, sometimes you might be sitting on a whole hand of cards that are just no good from, you know, we both talked about at the end of that game, we had, like, several cards that we had been sitting on for the entire game, mm-hmm. which can be frustrating, but also, you know, like, there's enough else going on in this game that I never felt like there wasn't something for me to do on my turn. It just didn't always feel like it was something that was going to get me necessarily closer to one goal or the other, you know?
Yeah, yeah. The cards are sort of randomly useful. I think one of my issues that I was having the other day is that, like you mentioned, I had at least one, probably two cards in my hand since the beginning of the game that were very, very situational. But in that situation, they would have been awesome. Mm-hmm. And I think I was kind of waiting for that situation to arrive instead of just trying yeah. to use them instead for their regular combat ability.
Yeah.
Part of that was because I didn't want to look up, like, when and how I get cards back. Mm-hmm. Like, if they go into the discard and then they get shuffled if the deck, like, goes through or whatever. Because the mm-hmm. deck is pretty thick, so I didn't think we would get all the way through it.
Yeah.
So part of it was that, you know, the reticence was, oh, I don't know if I'll ever get this card back. Mm-hmm. I think I probably should not have worried so much about that and just sort of used it in combat.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of cards I was just throwing out because I was at my hand limit for a large portion of the game. You know, the entire Fellowship, like all nine characters, are represented through character cards in this game. So if you're playing as the Fellowship, they all have like some sort of special ability. If you have them out on their own, or if they're part of the Fellowship, which is how everybody starts by default at the beginning of the game, whoever your guide is for the Fellowship has an ability that, you know, kind of affects the game state in some way. So like at the beginning of the game, Gandalf is your guide, and anytime I used a certain type of card, it allowed me to basically like replenish that card. Things like that. Mm-hmm. But then you can kind of break the characters off and move them around the board. And at that point, they're split from the Fellowship. And as far as we know, they can't rejoin. I don't know. There might be like some sort of card that allows that or something. We did not see that. But as far as we could tell, there was no way to kind of like join them back up. But that basically allows you to move them around on the board, allowing them to do special things. Like, you know, Gimli can go and get the dwarves closer to going to war, or I guess just activate them or whatever, right? Like, mm-hmm. like get them. Because there was two states for the cities. There was at war, and there was, what was the other one? What's the other state?
Passive versus active.
Passive versus active, right. Yeah, so Gimli could, you know, like, make the dwarves one or the other, and Legolas the elf can make the, you know, the elven people. I guess the elven people are already active at the beginning of the game, but you've got Boromir that can, like, affect one of the human nations, and Aragorn can go affect one of the human nations, and so on and so on. Yeah. And so you can move the characters around on the board doing those sorts of things. You can keep them with the Fellowship for some reason, I guess, if you have a reason to do that. There's a lot going on here, right? I mean, like strategically, I had really no clear idea of what I wanted to do other than move the hobbits towards Mordor at the beginning of the game. And then as the game went on, I was like, okay, yeah, so I actually should be taking my time with them, picking and choosing which rounds I use to do that, because on certain rounds, it's easier for Sauron, the Sauron player, to progress that track. You know, like the catch the hobbits track or whatever they call it, when I move. So there should be certain turns where you're a little bit more conservative with that. There's a little bit of risk reward and strategy there. And then in the meantime, like, I was trying to play very defensively with the cities that you were trying to take, you know?
Yeah. So the balancing act, I think, or your decision whether or not to move the Fellowship should, I think, primarily be based on how many dice are initially assigned right. by the Sauron player to the Hunt for the Ring.
Right.
So it's kind of the balancing act that the Sauron player has to do, which is, I can devote a lot of resources to finding the Hunt for the Ring, but that means that I don't get as many resources, as many dice to do other things like build and move and attack with armies.
Yeah.
So in that situation, like if I put like 5 of the 7 dice into the Hunt for the Ring, the Free People's player might look at that and be like, oh, there's a lot devoted to this. I probably won't move them this turn.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then I can do other things with my dice, like start to move people towards war or build up armies or whatever else.
Yeah.
But then, of course, the opposite is also true. So, like, if I only devote 1 die to it, I'll have a lot of resources to build and move armies and stuff like that, but it might be safer for the Fellowship to move.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, you know, there's definitely like a balance here to each side, although it does feel as the Free Peoples that you are, it feels like you're always, you know, behind the eight ball somewhat, right? Like you have fewer units on the board at all times, it seems like. You're the one being hunted, not doing the hunting. Mm-hmm. You can't replenish the army in the same way that the Mordor player can, because anytime your units die, they are out of the game. When the Mordor units die, they can be resummoned later on. They just, you know, all it takes is an action to bring those units back in the future. So you know that your total potential units are just constantly dwindling as the Free People's player throughout the game. It feels very oppressive.
Yeah.
Like as the Free People's player, it feels pretty hopeless. But at the same time, it's, you know, like it's still interesting and fun to, you know, make that attempt to get to Mordor, or, you know, like make some, you know, like I could see myself really enjoying making just a really big push to try to take over a couple of cities at the right moment, you know. Mm-hmm. And you might fail, right? And if you do that and you put all your eggs into that basket, you're probably screwed for the rest of the game. But that would be fun to do, you know. Like it was fun for me to just throw the hobbits at Mordor, kind of, you know, with abandon, like I did, you know, and just very recklessly. But I know that's not how I should do it. But I still enjoyed that particular attempt that I made. I think that I would enjoy the game a little bit more having played it in the past. Like, you know, if I play this again with you in the future, I think I'll enjoy it more knowing what can and can't happen a little bit better.
Yeah.
Knowing a little bit better how I should and shouldn't act on what turns based on the game state. Mm-hmm. And also, I think that if we just had an actual relaxed day where we had nothing else going on, then this is a game that I think that I could enjoy. In the situation we played it in, I didn't have a bad time with it. I think there was a lot that was interesting, but I don't think that I was relaxed enough to like really truly enjoy this game, which really demands you to like, you know, allow it to breathe and give it the time that it really needs in order to sing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that you got to go into this game knowing that it needs some room in the day in order to really, you know, come to life and be played the way that it needs to be played.
Yeah, I think a learning session of playing the game is probably not going to be fun for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot to do, and before you know, it's going to take you like half of the game basically to sort of figure out how things work and fit together and stuff like that. And so that whole first experience is basically like, okay, like now you know how to play the game. Next time you can have a better time.
Yeah. Yeah. So Jason, you are on record as saying this is your favorite game.
Yes.
Yes. So I think we already know your take on it. Do you have any sort of like criticisms of it or anything that you feel like people should know that I haven't already mentioned regarding whether or not this would be a good game for them?
Well, I mean, my main criticism of it is, at least from one perspective, is that the characters are kind of weak. Mm-hmm.
They don't do a lot.
No, they don't.
I expected more.
Yeah. So yeah, there's like a, I don't know. There's this feeling of like, oh yes, now Aragorn or Strider is now Aragorn, heir right. to Isildur, and all this kind of stuff. But that doesn't do a whole lot. Like every character does have a special ability, but again, it seems to be fairly situationally appropriate. And they're equally as fragile as any other unit on the board, basically.
If you put them into a conflict.
If you put them in a fight, yeah.
You can basically, like, protect them from a battle that's happening in the same area as them if you want to keep them alive.
Yeah, but if they're involved in the battle, there's a good chance they'll die.
And they're just gone. Yeah. So, yeah. And Aragorn, getting Aragorn, turning Strider into Aragorn, and turning Gandalf the Grey into Gandalf the White are two ways to get, the only two ways, I believe, to get two extra dice for the Free Peoples. So you go from four to six dice if you have both of those characters out. But then if they die, you lose those dice. So
yeah.
It feels like you just want to like turn them into those other characters and then go hide them in a vault. Because now they're worth like, you know, like 33% of your actions every single round, which is huge.
Yeah, so, oh, excuse me. Wait, the time change is really messing me up. Yeah, but so that I think if anything that would be sort of my main critique is that there should be some more weight and value to the individual characters.
I think that you know, this is a big game and it comes with a whole lot, so this is a tiny little nitpick, but the models aren't always super clear what they are.
Oh yeah, that's true too.
I had a really hard time determining, you know, what was Rohan versus what was, I don't know, whatever the other human nations were. Gondor. And everything. Yeah, or even the elven nations. Like, those elven sculpts didn't look that different from the human sculpts. And so that was kind of a challenge. And I mean, like, the fellowship sculpts weren't always, you know, they're just not, they're not huge. They're small minis. And so there can't be a lot of detail to them. And so they, you know, they're not the most impressive minis in the world. But yeah. At the same time, this isn't the most expensive game in the world for a game that's this large and this epic and everything. I think it, like, retails for $90 and you can get it cheaper than that often.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think what you're getting is pretty awesome, you know, for a game that is this well-designed, this sort of like thematically rich while also being very mechanically and strategically interesting. If you're interested in a game that is going to give you an entire Sunday's worth of entertainment, as long as you allow the game to have all of Sunday, you know, then this can be a pretty awesome time.
A whole day's worth of entertainment.
Yeah. If you're in a rush, don't play this game.
Yeah, right.
If you're impatient, don't play this game. But, you know, if you like the idea of spending the better part of a Sunday afternoon hanging out with one of your friends and trying to crush them under the weight of Sauron's eye, then this might be the game for you.
Sounds good to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Any other thoughts on War of the Ring, second edition?
Not really. There are a couple of expansions out for it. I haven't really played with them
mm-hmm.
In terms of the mechanics that they add.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that does. I'd actually be really interested to try
that. When you showed me the expansions, I was just like, this game does not need an expansion, no, Jason.
It certainly does not. I mean, primarily what they do is add more more of like the named characters from the lore.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, maybe they're more effectual than the ones that are actually in the game. I don't know. But if they aren't, then it seems like just a, you know, if you get bored playing the game, try it with this thing.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, well, we will be back probably in a couple weeks. We've got quite a few games to talk about now, so there shouldn't be any major delays other than the ones that get caused by, you know, life. But if you would like to get a hold of us and let us know which faction of Elf from Middle Earth is your favorite, how would they do so, Jason?
Okay, well, to throw your hat in the ring for the Sindarin elves like me, you can email us. It's podcast@limitedplaytime.com. You can go to the website, limitedplaytime.com. You can go to Twitter, which is @limitedplaytime, and Instagram @limitedplaytimepodcast.
I figured that would be sort of a softball for you. I couldn't come up with a single name of any of them other than, like, I remember Galadriel. But
she's the lady of Lorien.
Mm-hmm, yep. Yeah. She's scary in that movie.
She is.
Yeah.
A queen.
Terrible queen or whatever. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so we will be back in probably 2 weeks. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you then. Bye bye.
Later.
Bonus rambling.
Let's do another quick one. Mario.
Yoshi.
Donkey Kong.
Donkey Konga is what I think of.
Okay.
This is like a word association game.
Yes. Banana.
I don't know any other characters in Donkey Kong.
There's Cranky Kong. Let's see. There's Donkey Kong Jr. There's, Mario, but he was actually Jumpman in the original Donkey Kong. And then there's, what's her name? The princess.
There's a princess in Donkey Kong?
There's a girl. I want to call her Penelope, but that's not right.
Okay.
It's
not Peach?
No. She shows up in the most recent Mario game, though, the one on the Switch. She's like the mayor of New Donk City.
It's Mayor
Pauline is the girl that, Donkey Kong steals Pauline, and Jumpman, which is later on turns out to be Mario, has to save her from the Donkey Kong.
Okay.
And so he jumps from platform to platform and gets the hammer sometimes, and that lets him break the barrels that Donkey Kong throws.
What a silly game.
It's a pretty good game. Let's just do this episode on Donkey Kong.
Okay. I mean, I've never played, so I can really...
Never played the original Donkey Kong?
No.
Like the 1980 arcade classic, 1881, 80, 81, whatever. You've never played that?
No, I'm fairly certain I've never played that.
You like were never like six in a pizza parlor in like 1985 or whatever and just happened to be like sit down and play at a cocktail cabinet.
No, the one that was in our local pizza parlor was Pac-Man.
Oh, well, I mean, like, oftentimes they got kind of, like, converted back and forth back then. They would, like, take the board out of one and then put, like, another one and, you know, swap them out. But I don't know if they did that with cocktail cabinets because maybe it was harder to, like, change the art on those or something. I don't know. We had, like, Centipede and then, like, Galaga at a local Dairy Queen, and I feel like it was always the same cocktail cabinet.
Yeah, the only one I can remember at all is... Oh, no, sorry, they also had Asteroid.
Oh, yeah. We had Asteroids for a bit, too, at that Dairy Queen in the same cocktail cabinet, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe also Pac-Man and also maybe Donkey Kong. But they never did have the Popeye game there. They had the Popeye game at a different pizza place. And that's basically just Donkey Kong again.
Hey, there was a Popeye game?
Yeah. Originally, Donkey Kong, I think it was going to be Popeye. And then, like, the... didn't get the license or something. There's some story behind it. And so then they ended up just making Donkey Kong. And then like a year, two, three, four later, they finally did make Popeye and it's based on the Donkey Kong engine. So they play very similarly.
Okay.
You save olive oil in that game, not Pauline.
Oh.
and it's Brutus or Bluto, not Donkey Kong.
Does Bluto throw barrels?
I don't remember. I think Olive Oil throws hearts, though, that, like, float down from the top, and you can catch them.
Oh, that's sweet.
And you get, like, spinach instead of the hammer. It's basically the same game.
Sure.
But you can, like... Yeah, it's basically the same game. All right, let's
do
this.
I never really understood why Popeye was into Olive Oil.
I mean, dude's a sailor.
I guess. I mean, well, if he's been at sea long enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's the only girl I ever saw in all those cartoons.
In all those cartoons.
That's why him and Bluto are fighting over her, right?
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.